Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. And in this case, it's a co-production along with Gay Mormon Stories Podcast. I'm your host, John DeLynn. And as always, I'm very excited to have this guest with me. I am on the phone. I am on Skype with Brett Bradshaw. The last name may be familiar to some of you. Brett is the son of Marge and Bill Bradshaw. Bill Bradshaw, I've had him on Mormon Stories a few times now. He was a professor of mine when I was at BYU, a biology professor and a religion professor. He was my mentor for sure. You know, former member of a stake presidency, former mission president, the Hong Kong mission, along with his wonderful wife, Marge. And Bill has also become one of the leading advocates for gays and lesbians and LGBTQ individuals within the LDS Church. And he's also one of the co-principal investigators on my dissertation research, which is dealing with the same-sex attracted slash LDS experience in the church. And, you know, there are lots of reasons that my cousin Daniel Parkinson and I, Daniel, who is the host of Gay Mormon Stories, wanted to bring on Brett Bradshaw. Those of you who follow Mormon Stories will know that last week we will have released an interview with Josh and Lolly Weed. And I'm really proud of that interview. I really love Josh and Lolly. And they represent an LDS couple that are in what's called a mixed orientation marriage. And if you watch or listen to that interview, you'll know that these are great people who are living sincerely according to their values and what they feel is right. But that only tells sort of, you know, one side of a story. In reality, the vast majority of people who experience same-sex attraction in the LDS Church end up not taking that path for a variety of reasons. And so it's important as part of Mormon Stories and Gay Mormon Stories to profile, you know, different paths, hopefully all of which are constructive, healthy, you know, paths or role models. And we chose Brett for a number of reasons. One is that he is, you know, legally married to his husband, Jeff Jackenitz, and we'll be talking about his relationship with Jeff. We'll be talking about what it's like to be in a legal gay marriage. And it's also important to understand that Brett and Jeff have a daughter that was born through surrogacy. Her name is Madeline, and we'll be talking about how that works as well. And, you know, no one necessarily wants to be a role model, but, you know, the idea is to hold up or to shine a light on Brett and Jeff and their relationship and their family to understand what, you know, a same-sex marriage and a same-sex family can be like or can look like. And also, you know, we'll kind of end in you know, Josh Weed's case, he stayed in the church and has found happiness there. In Brett's case, he's chosen to, you know, part ways in some ways with the LDS Church. But I think when we talk about his profession and his life, we'll see that for those who do decide that they need to leave the church, and again, around 70% do, according to our data, you know, this is an example of a healthy, hopefully, you know, happy, healthy relationship and a path for those who feel like they need to leave. So without any further ado, Brett Bradshaw, welcome to Mormon Stories and Gay Mormon Stories.
Thanks, John. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I've been an admirer of you and the podcasts, both the ones you've done and the ones that Daniel has done, and just excited to have the opportunity to talk more. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. So let's begin just with your, you know, Mormon story. I imagine that being the son of a mission president and the son of all the various callings that Dr. Bradshaw has had, that the church was probably a pretty important part of your early years. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I am fifth generation Mormon. So on both sides of the family. So my dad's side of the family converted in the UK. In fact, both sides did, but my dad's side, I don't remember the year off the top of my head, but would have been in the 1840s, I imagine. And then they immigrated to the US. So my dad's side of the family, I think the Bradshaw side came through St. Louis, took a ship across the pond, as it were, came through St. Louis and then made their way to Utah. On my mom's side, they immigrated through Canada, came down. I think they made a brief stop in Illinois and then out to Utah initially. And then her family settled in Wyoming, in Star Valley, Wyoming, which is a little LDS enclave there. So yeah, many generations of Mormons, and on both my mom and dad's side, it was sort of a typical big Mormon family, lots of siblings. So I grew up with, seeing lots of cousins, lots of family. Both sides of the family were educators by profession. Both sides sort of active churchgoers, leaders in lots of callings, sort of well-respected figures. So the way I sort of talk about it is there was just a strong legacy of active Mormonism and sort of accomplishment on both sides. So I was well aware of that growing up and had a lot of example of family members, cousins, uncles, aunts, et cetera, that were sort of pillars of the community, both in Salt Lake, where my dad was raised, and in Star Valley, Wyoming, where my mom was raised.
So give a sense for, you know, what role the church played in your immediate family while you were growing up and what it played for you.
Yeah, so it's funny. I describe myself as being raised by progressive Mormons, if such a thing exists. Well, we know such a thing exists, though. When I typically describe that to people not familiar with the faith, they sort of think that is an oxymoron, right? So right. How can there be progressive Mormons? So, you know, my parents both did LDS missions. They met on their LDS mission in Hong Kong. Soon after they returned, I think my mom got home first. My dad got back later. He courted her soon thereafter they got married, and my dad had been, and then they moved to Boston, where my dad was in school at Harvard. So mom had finished her undergraduate degree at University of Wyoming, and then they moved to Boston. So I think for them, they had a little bit of an exposure outside sort of the typical Mormon enclaves in Utah and Wyoming in which they were raised. And so I think some of that different experience rubbed off in their political views, in their social views. So I think me and my siblings were raised. I'm the fourth of five kids. So we were raised sort of with that mindset. I was born in Seattle, where my dad was doing a postdoc at the University of Washington. After that point, a couple of years after I was born, we moved to Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where my dad took a job at one of the federal nuclear labs that's in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. My youngest brother, Ben, was born there. And then in Utah, where my dad took a faculty position at BYU. So my early years were sort of doing some of that transitioning from Seattle to Tennessee back to Utah. And it was in, trying to remember the sequence of events here. Soon after we got back to Utah, my dad was an associate professor at BYU, and then not long after got the call to be a mission president in Hong Kong. So all of my parents' children were born by that time. The youngest, Ben, probably would have been 2 years old. I was four at the time. And we then made that transition and moved to Hong Kong for 3 years. So lived in Hong Kong from age four to age seven. I guess just we can go into some greater detail on that if that's of interest. I would say about my participation in the LDS Church was that it gave me lots of advantages, I felt like. So the metaphor I'll use is gave me a passport, sort of both literally and figuratively. So on the literal side, I was able to, the experience of being the child of two sort of active, committed Mormons who then were called to be mission parents, you know, gave me the opportunity to go live abroad for 3 years, which was a spectacular opportunity for a four-year-old to live abroad and have that experience. So in Hong Kong, I went to a British school. In that class at school were kids from all over the globe whose families were, you know, probably doing business in Hong Kong. So there were Dutch families, U.S. families, Korean families from all over. And just having that exposure, I felt like was or as I look back and reflect on it now, that was a spectacular opportunity that I had access to as a result of my participation and my family's participation in the LDS Church. And then I think beyond that, sort of the more figurative elements of having a passport, you know, that activity and the fact that both sides of my families were active leaders in the church and were well regarded just gave me a lot of opportunity and a lot of advantage. So I look back at those years, you know, pretty fondly, you know, and then after we returned back to Utah, lived in Orem, which is smack dab in the middle of Utah County, lived there from second grade through the end of high school. And a lot of your listeners know they call Utah Valley Happy Valley. And on the veneer, it has just a sense of being a stable community where, I don't know, it's sort of similar to what Garrison Keillor says about Lake Wobegon, right? That every kid's above average and everything is wonderful and fabulous.
All the women are good looking or something like that.
Yeah, right. All the women are good looking and the children are all above average. So that sort of experience that I lived, at least growing up there, of having a lot of advantages, and I wouldn't say that they weren't monetary advantages. So, but just access to opportunities through church activity, access to opportunity through, you know, I was in scouting, I was an Eagle Scout, just had opportunities to develop myself. And having come from Utah, that also gave me, I think, some privileges once I went to college. I think my guess, I don't know for sure, but my guess is I applied to a bunch of colleges and being admitted to colleges, there was an element of having some cultural diversity, you know, represented by me coming right from the West and coming from Utah as a sort of green Mormon boy.
Right. Just real quickly, you know, what role did the spiritual elements of Mormonism play in your life personally? Like, you know, I imagine some of the traditional things, scripture study, prayer, family home evening, you know, testimony building, any of that, you know, hymn singing. Did you ever connect with the spiritual side of Mormonism personally? And if so, how?
Yeah, yes, I did. And I have sort of, I guess it's the luxury of looking back at that period of time. So I was exposed to all of, you know, we were active churchgoers, went pretty much every week. I had various callings, did scouting through the ward. So for anybody who knows Utah County, you know, 85 or 90%, well, I don't know what it is now, but at the time it seemed like to me 85 or 90% of the population is LDS. Certainly that was the case in my high school. So I went to Orem High, and I was the seminary president at Orem High School during the years I was there, 1981 to 1985. So I definitely had what I would have called then spiritual experiences as it related to my experience with the LDS Church. So at the time would have said with absolutely had a testimony, frequently bore testimony at fast and testimony meetings, would have been seen by other people as a true blue Mormon. Though it's interesting, on the other hand, you know, our family politically, we were Democrats, which made me an outlier in a lot of regards. So I guess this has to do a little bit with what I was just talking about, in that having this privilege of, you know, having a legacy of strong Mormons, I think allowed me, though, to experiment a little bit and be a little bit on the edge in how I expressed my views about politics. And, you know, I remember in fourth grade, there was a mock election. It was the 1976 presidential election, and I was like the only one in the class that voted for Jimmy Carter, you know, when
right.
he ran against Gerald Ford. So, you know, but I think I had the ability to do that because of how I was sort of positioned or situated with regard to all of this other opportunity and this legacy, right? So,
a lot of privilege.
And the privilege.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. So, you know, now that I've had all kinds of other experiences post sort of my initial upbringing, I don't discount the way I was raised, the spiritual experiences that I would have called them then. I see them a lot differently now, through the lens of things I've studied, things I've come to understand. You know, I had a lot of emotional experiences as a young person, and, you know, and did my LDS mission and had a set of experiences there. So I don't discount them. I just understand them a little bit differently now as a older adult.
But the church inspired you. You felt like you had a strong testimony. You felt like it was a good thing. And if there was any, you probably would have characterized feeling some type of power or strong influence or inspiration from your experiences with it.
Absolutely. And, you know, my first year in college when I, you know, I went to the University of Chicago, so the first year in college before I went on my mission, again, I enjoyed that privilege because I was known as, I was this sort of, this exotic creature who, you know, came from Utah, who talked about these kind of things in a different way. So people, I think, were drawn to me in some ways because of that. And I was able to, and I represented as a Mormon, you know, I gave copies of the Book of Mormon to my roommates and stuff like that. So yes, I would definitely say I had that. That was definitely part of my identity up until I was, you know, until I came back from my mission.
Okay. So when did you first experience same-sex attraction?
Yeah, good question. I remember being attracted to guys as early as junior high. I certainly didn't have language at that time to call myself gay or to think of myself as having a trajectory or a future as a gay man or as a gay person. So it's an interesting thing. So I have clear memories of being attracted to guys, though it's funny that I guess it has something to do with how the brain works and levels of consciousness and subconsciousness. I just think I wasn't wired at the time for that to make sense to me. If that makes sense.
Makes total sense.
So, you know, through high school, you know, I dated girls, went to dances with girls. When I thought of myself consciously in the future, I thought of myself as going on a mission, getting married to a woman, sort of doing what sort of the heteronormative life, the role models around me of that were sort of heteronormative. That was, I think, both consciously and subconsciously were what was true for me.
Now, they're kind of, I don't know, gender-based stereotypes, I'll call it, that we have for what we consider in, you know, let's say in U.S. culture as being masculine and feminine. And then often with the same-sex attracted youth, you know, who's male, you know, their gender characteristics will be perceived as more feminine by many of their peers kind of in adolescence. But that's not always the case. So, you know, right. the average young gay male, you know, might be viewed as effeminate, or, you know, everyone will kind of know that they're gay but not talk about it. You know, the parents might have had a good sense of that from maybe even age 7 or 6 or even younger. Was any of that the case with you?
Good question. I think it's mixed, right? So I was athletic. I played sports, you know, played football and basketball and baseball. So on one level, I did a bunch of things that in the gay community we would call butch, right? So I, on some level, was really quite butch. On the other hand, I, you know, this is, it's always funny with the luxury of retrospection that people can go back and say, yeah, there was something, I always noticed something about Brett that now it kind of all falls into place now that he's out and it's all sort of out in the open. There were some things that I could tell, that I could detect. So I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say that when I was growing up, my parents would have necessarily predicted that I would have been gay. I think when I came out to my dad, he was, I haven't talked to him about this recently, but my guess is he was thoroughly shocked, had no idea, did not realize. My mom had, go ahead.
What were the things that, looking back, you would have associated with being more stereotypical?
Sort of a level of sensitivity. So I, among my siblings, probably am characterized as of the more sensitive both to sort of my own emotions, but also in caretaking others and sort of having a sense external to me about what's going on emotionally with other people.
Okay.
So that would be one thing. You know, I don't know, you know, also being somewhat, you know, socially at ease both with other boys when I was young, but in particular with girls. So having just a little bit more sort of kind of social ease, being able to code switch, as it were, between, you know, people I played football or sports with, but then just as easily being able to participate and have friends with people in the choir or people who did drama and then girls as well. So that maybe was another thing.
And did girls find you attractive? I know it's a weird question, yeah. But.
Yeah. I know people, Jeff, my husband, and my close friends make fun of me all the time because I will recount this story about being in high school. And, you know, there was this dance called preference where it was sort of the girl's choice. And I was sort of named the most preferred guy 2 years in a row.
Oh.
So I, like, whenever I get into sort of a jocular back and forth, I will raise that to raise my stature that I was the most preferred 2 years in a row.
So Jeff broke a lot of hearts, basically.
He did, but yeah. But
yeah. Were you ever attracted to girls?
Yeah. I mean, I did. It's interesting. When I use the Kinsey scale for myself, like as an adult,
right.
I put myself on the far pole of being gay. So as an adult, being sort of like sexually attracted, I would say I'm most definitely all the way sexually attracted to men.
Six. You're saying you're a six.
I'm saying I'm a six.
Okay.
Wouldn't say I'm bi. Didn't have any sexual experiences with women before coming out. So, but in high school, I think because of how, you know, knowledge and experience is socially constructed, I, you know, thought I was doing what I was supposed to do, right? Which is flirt, you know, that flirt with girls, go on dates with girls. Now, on some level, I'm not saying there weren't meaningful connections between myself and girls. though now as I look back, you know, being adult and having sort of grown into myself, as it were, I would say I wasn't sexually attracted to girls.
Okay. But at the time you were kind of flirty and, you know, interested.
Yeah.
And
But
never explored that. So you didn't even really know the depths of it. You just kind of did what guys did socially.
Correct.
Okay. So never a serious girlfriend or anything then, really?
Never a serious girlfriend.
Okay. And did you conceptualize that as my mission's really important to me and I'm not going to get distracted before my mission kind of thing?
Yeah, or, you know, I didn't find the right person I think it became more acute in college. So came back from my mission.
Okay, wait, really quick. I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Never the oh my gosh, I'm gay thing in high school. Never had that experience. Like privately.
I wouldn't describe it as doing that, but I did, particularly in high school. Later on in high school, I had crushes on boys, but that's the language I use now.
Right.
Close friendship. But there was something awkward about it, but I certainly was going through the emotions, sort of the emotional sort of connection with some of my friends or the guys that I was attracted to that I then sort of created opportunities to be around a lot.
Right.
So that was sort of the wish fulfillment, right? But without the fully constructing the thoughts and the intentions in my mind. So I think later there were some times like I may have uttered the words like, oh my gosh, I think I might be gay, but it was never fully realized like, yeah, oh, this, I definitely know what's going on.
And one of the things we find in our study is that a lot of people's, and this is going to sound kind of explicit, but you know, I think it's fair. I mean, I think it's good to talk about this kind of stuff. Some people have their kind of sexual awareness or awakening, like in the locker room where they're like dressing and they see other guys and it's kind of a really embarrassing thing, but they find themselves really attracted. Others don't. Was that ever a part of it or not really?
No, I was looking, I was sneaking peeks in the locker room, all of that.
Okay.
Yes, and yes.
Okay. Okay, so you serve a mission as this true blue Mormon, right?
Yep.
And is there anything relevant to your, you know, sexual orientation that occurred on your mission?
Interesting. Not directly, but I think indirectly. So
okay.
I served in Brazil, in São Paulo, Brazil, which, you know, by the way, is full of beautiful people, both men and women. But so there were moments in my mission where on a conscious and subconscious level continued this narrative. I guess it's not even narrative. It's an actual experience of being attracted to men there. Though I think I did have this singleness of purpose that it wasn't disruptive. You know, I went about my business, you know, I did my mission, you know, and I think the larger awakening, as I would call it, that I had on my mission was, I think, maybe not totally disconnected from more coming into myself as a gay person, but an awakening of having some doubts about my faith.
Oh.
So I don't think they're entirely disconnected, but the way I talk about it now is going on my mission was the beginning of the end for my faith, for my participation in Mormonism.
So we did a pretty big study on why Mormons leave the church, and there are kind of different categories. There's historical issues, there's doctrinal and theological issues, there's cultural issues, and there's even spiritual issues. Where people just feel either not edified in church or feel spiritually drawn elsewhere. And there's kind of, you know, kind of political issues, socio-political issues.
Right.
Were your main issues in any of those categories or were they in other categories?
Some of all, but the one that stands out for me is the second one you mentioned, sort of the doctrinal issues of doctrine, issues of just having doubts and questions about that. And I think how it transpired for me on the mission is in this way. The mission I was in, I think at the time I was called, had the highest rate of baptism in the world. So it was, you know, Brazil is a Catholic Christian nation, but the mission itself and the country in terms of conversions was growing at an astronomical rate. And the mission president at the time was, his orientation was to baptize. So I think getting back to the way I was raised by my parents is I had some expectation going on my mission that it was about service in a broader sense. And I had both sort of an internal compass, but a set of expectations that I was going to be engaged in activities that would be helping people broadly. So I'm going to, you know, Brazil's a, particularly in the neighborhoods where I was working as a third world nation, people need all kinds of help. And so for me, the prospect, the idea of offering solely I wouldn't even call it a spiritual dimension of service. It was, and the way the mission was structured is you met a family, you did the first discussion, and you asked the family at the end of the first discussion to commit to more and even to commit to be baptized. And if they didn't say yes, you were to leave and not have more contact and go find somebody else who would commit to that. So for me, it became in my mind so narrowly focused on the service being geared towards converting people, which met quotas, which met numbers, and not about really caring for people, learning more about them, learning to appreciate them and their culture. Also, I had a lot of dissonance around assimilation and going to a country different from my own and having a sense about the LDS Church as being a relatively American religion and that what I was doing was sort of proselytizing and trying to get people to assimilate into my way and had a lot of issues and problems with that.
Kind of cultural colonialism.
Absolutely.
How many baptisms a month at the peak of your mission experience do you think for your mission?
I can't remember mission-wide, but
often it's in, you know, the higher baptizing missions are between 500 and 1,000 a month kind of thing.
Yeah, my guess is that would be in the range. I mean, me personally, you know, it wouldn't be uncommon to have 3-4 baptisms a week.
Whoa.
And certainly. Yeah, you know, you'd meet people and there'd be like a huge pipeline, right? And that was how the whole mission was constructed and that's how you were trained. And if you use the metaphor of the factory model, that was it, right? You know, there was a pipeline and you would meet people and you were supposed to meet so many new families every week. And from those new families, you were, you know, so it's sort of like backward planning. You wanted to have 3 or 4 baptisms a week. You would have to then meet X number of new families every week.
Like a channel.
And that was drilled into you from the beginning. And I had a problem with it. And in fact, so much so that I was on a running list. I probably were headed this list frequently, but I was on the list of the elders who had the longest consecutive baptismless stretch.
So
I had a reputation of being sort of the one who thought about things and didn't always toe the line, and it was a challenge for me.
Yeah, just as an aside, my very first Mormon Stories episode was about my mission experience in Guatemala, which was very almost identical. How many? What year were you? What years were you there in Brazil?
86 to 88.
Okay, so we were contemporaries. I was in Guatemala from 88 to 90. So it was right during that golden age.
Yep, that's right.
There was
that's
a mission right. in Chile during that time, the Viña del Mar mission that had over 1,000 baptisms a month. So,
yeah.
Okay. So that sort of put some cracks in your testimony. And you, I guess you had mentioned that you noticed a lot of attractive people and probably were attracted to some of the Brazilian men down there. Anything else related to your sexual orientation and your mission, or is that pretty much it?
That's pretty much it. I mean, the way I think back on it now, I really feel like I put a lot of stuff on hold for that 2 years. So it was, I think I was able, I wasn't battling with myself around my sexual orientation during my mission. It was around some of these other philosophical, spiritual questions around how I fit in into
right.
Mormonism and having some of that struggle.
Okay, so how did you go from returned missionary to coming out as gay? What was that process?
Yeah, so as I said, I think it was important in this period of time that I was outside of Utah. So I come back from my mission. I go back to college in Chicago, and that was seminal in a lot of ways. So I had some really fond memories of some great courses that I took. One of them being, the title of it was Self, Culture, and Society. And it was a sort of a, at Chicago, you're required to do it. They have a strong common core philosophy. So you essentially do a year of study in each of the main sort of disciplines. So there was sort of the sociology, sort of humanities areas. And so I took this class and we read, as you mentioned, the term you said, sort of cultural colonialism. So we read a lot about that. We read Durkheim, Levi-Strauss, Todorov, a bunch of other people. And so, and I wrote a lot of papers on my experiences from my mission. You know, I wrote a whole paper about me being a conquistador, the equivalent of a conquistador with my religion. So I think I had opportunity to do a lot of that intellectual exploration and felt a lot of agency to use my experience in my religion and what I was going through to be part of the fodder for what I was writing and thinking about. And I was active in the ward in Chicago. So it's still the Hyde Park ward. So University of Chicago is on the south side. And it was an entirely different kind of a church-going experience than I had experienced back in Utah. So the ward at that time was essentially half people who were affiliated with the university, and then half people who were local to the south side. And the south side of Chicago is predominantly African-American, so the ward was essentially half black and half university folks. And it was just a really nice mix of that. And so I think I was able, because of the orientation of a lot of the people in the ward, free thinkers, intellectuals, that came through in Sunday school classes and the way it was taught. I taught classes myself, so just sort of immersed myself in that. So, but I think it ultimately served the purpose of distancing me somewhat, allowing me to further pursue sort of my thinking about some of these things, furthering some of my doubts, and then also allowing me to more fully come out to myself. So I think those things were both happening at the same time. So having this somewhat challenging experience on my mission, being able to explore and think and doing that in this environment that was really stimulating for me, as well as, I think, because of my age and sort of developmentally becoming a little bit more aware of myself, but also being in Chicago where I was exposed to a lot of different things. So, you know, there was a LGBT student group at the university. So getting some of those images of out gay people helped to, I think, open up the possibilities for me in some way. So all of that is sort of going on. And at the same time, sort of exploring a little bit more my attractions to other men at school, at college in Chicago. And that, I think I was able at the time to take that in a way that it began to mean something to me.
So a couple common phases, especially for young Mormon men that return from their missions and go to one of the BYU schools. One is the sort of desperate bargaining with Heavenly Father to take the same-sex attraction away Was that ever part of your experience? Kind of the hyper religiosity and bargaining with God as a way to make it go away. Did you just bypass that?
Pretty much. I didn't have much of that. And again, I think that's somewhat, well, I don't know whether it's somewhat rare or not. I don't have enough experience to know, but at least that wasn't my experience. And I think I try to think of what I could attribute that to. And I think it goes back to the way I was raised. So I don't know if what's idiosyncratic about that is what my parents were like, or the combination of my parents, you know, living and raising us in the community in which we were raised, which was a relatively conservative one, or if it is something inherent in me. I can't always say, but probably some convergence of a lot of those things made me feel like I had agency, that I could choose for myself what I was going to do, and that I didn't need to doubt myself about it. So I think it was my senior year in college where this, you know, I mean, if we use the phrase come to a head. So, I think I was sort of intellectually and emotionally distancing myself somewhat from Mormonism. At the same time, coming into my own and starting to get a better sense that I'm gay, meeting Jeff, my now husband. So at the time, we were both seniors in 1991. I remember seeing him in the library cantina. There was, you know, like in the basement of the library was a place where you would go and get snacks and stuff during breaks when you were studying. And I remember seeing him across the room and being attracted to him and noticing him, right? And he was one of the guys back then at the time in the libraries, as you left the building, you had to be screened. You had to open up your bags and somebody would look through them to make sure you weren't taking out books. And Jeff was one of those guys. And so I was drawn to him. We both had applied to Teach for America as seniors in college. So Teach for America is a teacher corps. Essentially the analogy is, it's the Peace Corps, but placing people in 2-year stints in under resourced school districts across the U.S. So he and I both did that. And so I remember having a sense of who he was. We both applied. So in the application process, you spent a lot of time with other applicants. I got to know him that way. And that was sort of in the spring of our senior year. And so as I would leave the library all the time, I would spend, you know, a lot of time just chatting and talking with Jeff as he was doing his job. And that was happening all at the same time as these other things were going on for me. And so I think subconsciously what's going on is I'm incredibly attracted to this person. And at the same time, I'm not fully disassociated with Mormonism and still am holding on to my upbringing and still feeling devoted to my family and, you know, not sure what fully coming out would mean for all of that, right? So all of that is going on at the same time. Jeff at the time is a little bit further out of the closet than I am, but he hadn't been with any men either at the time. He had dated women in college. But he had sort of decided, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm gay and I'm gonna give this a go. I think I'm gonna have my next relationship be with a guy, but I don't quite know what that means yet, but I'm open to it. So he's sort of in that place. I'm not quite that far along, but these things are all happening for me. We both get admitted to Teach for America. He gets placed in Houston. I get placed in Los Angeles.
What part of Houston? Just downtown Houston? Do you know?
The name of his school was Lantrip Elementary, and I don't.
Okay, that's fine. Exactly. I'm from Houston, so I was just curious. But it was
a neighborhood that was primarily Latino and was inside the belt, 610, whatever that is.
Yeah,
what do they
that's
call
fine.
It?
That's fine.
Yeah. Anyway, so all this is going on, and then we continue to spend a lot of time with each other. And I think for Jeff, Jeff's like confused. He can't figure me out. He can't figure out whether I'm just this naive Mormon boy or whether I'm really hitting on him, and he can't quite read the signals. So subconsciously, I'm sure I'm full on flirting and hitting on him, but I don't have the full awareness about that. It doesn't, again, it's not clicking with me entirely.
And real quick, had you tried dating women at this point?
No, still no. So it probably, you know, people ask me like, well, wasn't it obvious? Like people probably had this, had a sense like, you know, Brett's not really dating anybody seriously. There's probably something going on there. But I think unlike high school, in college, it was feeling a little bit more awkward, right? So I think at the time I could easily explain it away before my mission, like, well, I'm not going to really date women because I want to focus on my mission and then coming back. It just really didn't work. So I knew a lot of women, spent a lot of time with a lot of women, both other people in the ward in Hyde Park, as well as other people, you know, students with whom I was in classes. But no.
Okay.
Didn't have any dating experiences with women during that time.
Got it.
So at this point, Jeff and I are spending a lot of time together as we're, you know, gearing up to graduate, and we, through sort of the Teach for America infrastructure, we're, you know, getting excited about going to do this. The way the program worked at that time, it was just the second year of Teach for America. So what they were doing, and it was an upstart at the time, they were busing people from wherever they happened to be to Los Angeles, and you did a 2-month intensive summer institute. And the reason they did it in Los Angeles is because there were year-round schools in LA Unified at that time. So you could get a student teaching experience as well as do this intensive institute before then you were then flown out to wherever you were going to be doing your 2-year commitment. So the way it was going to work for me, where my parents were coming to graduation in Chicago, they drove out from Utah, and then I was going to drive with them back to Utah, spend a few weeks in Utah before I had to report to the Summer Institute in Los Angeles. So during a lot of this back and forth, I convinced Jeff to take the bus from Chicago to Salt Lake, spend a few days with me in Utah just to sort of see where I was from and spend a couple of days together with my family. And then we were going to drive together. We're going to do a road trip from Orem, where my parents' house was, down to Los Angeles and stop at the national parks in southern Utah and, you know, sort of take a week and have a road trip together. So that's what happens. And so during all this time, I'm kind of stealthily, even to myself, kind of exploring what this might mean for me. You know, I think back now is an incredibly exciting time, right? So really excited about, you know, falling for this person. It was also, you know, interestingly bizarre, you know, not being fully conscious about what was actually happening, not having full use of all my faculties and my intentions. So we graduate, we do this plan all happens. Jeff spends a couple of days with my family, meets my family. We hop in the car and drive down, and it's during this whole period. I think also during the last few months of college, while Jeff and I were spending a lot of time together, you know, we opened up, we had connection on a lot of levels. So it wasn't just on a physical level, had a lot of connections emotionally, had a lot of things in common. And then this, you know, over the course of this road trip together, we kind of open up a little bit more, confess to each other a little bit about our sort of feeling like we've been attracted to men at different points, sharing our experiences and having that deep connection with each other. So it's in the course of this road trip, Jeff actually makes the first move and states, you know, I'm really attracted to you and want to explore what that would mean, like what that would mean for us. And it's, in retrospect now, it's sort of obvious to me that I would sort of reciprocate that. But in the moment it was pretty shocking, because I think it was the first time that I actually had this conscious realization that this is something that I could pursue and this is something that I could do and that it would be real for me. So I'm sort of faced with it in the moment. In fact, it's a great story, because we were actually hiking the Narrows in Zion National Park, and we're, you know, like hiking through, you know, the Virgin River, whatever, we're in this fabulous, gorgeous, beautiful setting. And we stop for lunch, and, you know, we've been talking about stuff, you know, for hours in the car, what have you. And it's at this moment he sort of turns to me and drops this bomb. And I'm, you know, sort of shocked. And the thing I remember saying back to him is, yeah, I feel the same way, but it's not easy for me. Like, I still need to sort of figure this out, figure out what this means. If I were to sort of honor what my feelings are around this and really do what is feeling really natural and feeling really central and core to me, I would say, let's go for it. But I am not sure what that would mean to my family. So again, sort of the specter of coming out to my family sort of raised its head there. And I thought to myself, I'm not ready to do that. Not sure I can do that. Not sure what it meant. And again, I think it's both the flood of the conscious elements of what my upbringing, what Mormonism tells you about gay people, and also a lot of the subconscious stuff about representations of who gay people are, representations of you know, the lonely bachelor at the end of the street that's unhappy. I mean, those kinds of things that are represented in the media, that are represented in stories that people take in on a both a conscious and a subconscious level. I think all of that was coming up for me. And in a moment, you know, I hesitated. I was like, you know, I feel the same way as you do, but I'm not quite ready for this. So it made for a awkward drive. It made for an awkward drive from Zion's National Park. We stopped in Las Vegas on our way down to LA. So it was sort of a strange couple of days. But so given all of that kind of turmoil, relatively speaking, I can say now it was fairly easy. So after a couple of days of sort of ruminating on this, and I think I needed to have gone through what I went through in terms of my mission, in terms of all of what I just described, the last few years of college, me detaching somewhat from a sort of fundamental testimony and belief in Mormonism. I think all of that needed to happen in order for me to be in the place to say, you know what, I'm attracted to you, and this is something that I want. And yeah, so this is something I'm going to do. So anyway, so at that point, we decide we're going to give it a go. And so we're at this summer institute in Los Angeles. We're, you know, placed in different apartments in a tower, a residential tower at USC, University of Southern California. We're not out to anybody. We're terrified people know. We're just coming out to ourselves. This is the first experience for both of us. And we're dealing with all of that at the same time as we're figuring out how to be teachers, getting ready to, you know, Jeff getting ready to fly off to Houston, me staying in Los Angeles. So it was just a heavy, heavy period, but one that I look back on as being sort of really exciting, as well as, you know, sort of a new frontier for me.
And this is, you know, it should be noted that this is pre-Ellen, you know, pre-Glee, you know, sort of in 2013, you really can't have a TV show that doesn't have a gay character. And, right. You know, it's just, it's on the news everywhere. And, you know, 10 states or whatever now have legalized gay marriage. It was a totally different deal back in 91, 92, right?
It is on that level. On another level, I remember those years fondly, sort of coming out. And I mean, the other thing that is really significant about that period is it's very instrumental, very significant for me in terms of sort of the era of AIDS. So,
right,
it's sort of on the tail end. So a lot of people were still getting sick. A lot of people were dying, and that's a lot of the narrative too, was about the implications and the consequences of AIDS policy. So 91, it's George Herbert Walker Bush is president. So this was, you know, after the 91 was, I remember the first Iraqi war. So that year, senior year, I remember watching news about the war. So that's sort of going on at the time. So a lot of the, so for a lot of people my age and of people a little bit older too, who had been out already, you know, there's a vibrant gay community in Los Angeles at the time. So, and in Houston also for Jeff. So, as we're figuring this out, and then we, I'm kind of going in a couple of different directions, but let me say then that we had decided at the end of this institute that we entered into this sort of 2 month period thinking, you know, we're not making any commitments necessarily. We're just sort of figuring this out, to, when he left for Houston, sort of deciding that we were going to try to do this long distance relationship and keep and continue to give it a go, even though we were going to be in different cities. And in fact, that was, I think, really important for us both as a couple and both as individuals, because we didn't have to navigate. We were able to ease in really slowly. We didn't have to navigate all of the pressures about coming out along with trying to figure it out together, figure out our relationship together. So we were able to have our own lives with our own. We each had roommates that were also teachers. We both sort of dove into the respective gay communities in LA and in Houston. And then we saw each other really frequently. You know, we were on a teaching schedule, so pretty much every school holiday, one of us either flew, either I flew to Houston or he flew to Los Angeles. So we spent time together usually every 6 or 8 weeks. But that gave us a chance to sort of figure out what being gay was for us, but also what our relationship was. So I really appreciate that 2 years of time, even though on some level it was a challenge. But again, for me in Los Angeles, had a vibrant gay community, but also that's where I got initially connected to affirmation. And that was a also important thing for me to have happened during that period. So met some other, in fact, Paul Mortensen, who's one of the founders of Affirmation, who, you know, was coming out at BYU in 1978 or whatever, lived at the time, still lives, I believe, in Los Angeles, and was hosting Affirmation gatherings there. And I remember going to his place and meeting a bunch of people, and that being an important thing for me, to find other people of a similar background who had gone through, were going through some of the same things.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Well, oh, all is well, all is well. Why should we mourn? I think our lot is hard. 'Tis not so. All is right. Why should we think to journeys through.